Hi, the name's Neubronner, Dion Neubronner. You're listening to my podcast, Life, Purpose, Leadership. In this episode, which is episode 1 of 2, my guest is the gregarious and hugely talented Sandy Forbes Taylor. There is so much to tell you about Sandy, but suffice to say, she is a successful entrepreneur based in Australia, a wife and a mother. And she is on a mission to change the world one person, one community, at a time. In this episode, Sandy and I explore how things need to change, from the media to politicians and to ourselves, in order to make it a better place for us all, not just the few at the top. I hope you find the chat as useful as I have, having it. Life, purpose, leadership. Hello, Sandy Forbes Taylor. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you? Looking with your beautiful tan, looking very healthy.
Called a sunbed.
When you look tanned, you always look better than when you're pale and pasty like I currently am.
I wonder why that is. We seem to look healthier when we've got this tan on. But in real terms, if you spend your life on the sunbed, it's not healthy.
I don't know. Like when you, things just don't seem to look as pasty and wobbly when they're brown than when they're white.
I agree with you, because when I've got a tan, I'm more accepting of the visual image I have in the mirror when getting out of the bath, and there are loads of mirrors around the bloody bathroom, than I am when I'm in the depths of winter and I don't have a colour on my skin.
Yeah, definitely.
I really loved your blog post about the altruistic entrepreneur, the entrepreneur that does stuff not just for success and wealth and notoriety. The altruistic entrepreneur. What will it take to bring that change that you talk about? And I totally get your argument about making little steps, or making changes in your environment, making changes in your world. Tell me more about it.
Well, I think the way we look at the world, to a greater degree, I think we do almost what the world makes it easy for us to do. People are not very good at, I suppose, thinking in isolation. We don't have much sense of self in isolation, because everything we think about ourselves, because of the existence of other people. I think looking at our culture, looking at our society, we just accept that the way things are the way things are. When we look at the nature of our culture, the nature of other cultures, there's a lot that we can learn about how our society could change, how it could improve. I listened to an interesting talk on the nature of culture when you're talking about the difference between, for example, American culture, the Scandinavian culture, the Eastern cultures, and what they used to describe culture was two measurements. One was the masculine nature of culture and the feminine nature, not male and female, but the characteristics, and the tightness and the looseness of a culture. So a culture that was very tight would be one like some of the Eastern countries, where it's not everybody for himself. There is a very clear path to how you do things a certain way. People like us do things a certain way, whereas culture like American culture is, you can be as individualistic as you like. You can cuddle your own canoe, live whatever way you like. Masculine culture and feminine culture. Masculine culture is very much about achievement. It's about goal orientation. It's about being the best, being the strongest, being the more dominant.
Which is the Western world.
It is. Feminine culture is more about collaboration. It's more about consultation. That's how females tend to be more collaborative, more aware of everybody in the group, rather than, you know, it's each man for himself. So I think.
And you're defining culture as the way we do things, the way we as a collective, as a society, as communities, as individuals.
Yeah. You know, we look at our culture and we think that it's a fixed thing, that it has to work this way because that's the way it is. The US is an outlier because it's, you know, most
economically more powerful than.
Yeah. And they, because they're so individualistic about their culture, it's like, we are the best. You people all need to look at what we're doing. Our movies, our literature, a lot of that is based on how American culture works. And that has kind of permeated into our culture.
A personal reference for me is I came to the United Kingdom in 1994. So over 30 years ago, I came here. And I came to London over 20 years ago. And I remember setting foot in London and thinking to myself, wow, this place is so different to what I've been used to. And what I was used to was a South African culture, which was very American. It was very individualistic. And it always has been in my experience. And I found that over the last 20 years, London and British culture has become more American. It's become more individualistic. And I find it difficult that I have a problem with that, because I guess when I first came here, I had those masculine views or masculine traits of wanting to achieve and success, and I identified with the individualistic perspective on achievement and movement and developing oneself and growing and becoming successful. But obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but over the years, that has softened. And I guess I've adopted more of the feminine traits around collaboration and altruism and giving and serving others. I suppose in a way, when I first came here, I still wanted to serve others, but I wanted to serve others in order to get somewhere. There was a need to achieve something. Whereas now there's a shift, and that shift is I want to serve others. And it isn't anything other than that purposeful, intentional desire to want to serve others.
We have this reference in our mind that, you know, the only way forward is to be better, is to be the best and to have bigger and more. And so that's only one view. It's not the right or the wrong way. So when we look at other cultures, perhaps like the Scandinavian cultures that tend to be more feminine, even the government of Netherlands, that is a lot more inclusive. I'm not saying one is right and one is wrong, because obviously, because the US is so individualistic, if you think of all the innovation that has come about because of that way of being, there is no alternative. There's no fallback position. You know, you kind of push ahead, because if you don't, the alternative's not worth thinking about. I was reading some stuff that was saying that in the Scandinavian cultures, they are having trouble, even though uni is free, they're having trouble getting people to go to uni. Why would you, when you can just be on like unemployment and you can earn pretty much what? There is no incentive to really make an effort. So I'm not saying that one is wrong and one is right, but I'm saying that, okay, so you've got these contrasts, and then you follow the logical thinking and you think, well, so what does that mean? Does that mean we need to go to a sort of a socialist framework where everybody's equal and everyone gets the same? I don't believe that that's the answer either. Really, the thing that jumps out at me as the issue is our paternalistic society more than our individual society, because when you think about the history of most governments, most institutions, education, religion, the biggest issue is that we've been trained to wait for instructions. School, the children who do well are not the children who are creative thinkers. They are the children who can sit still until they are given further instructions. They can behave appropriately. Education was set up to create people to work in factories, to create a production line, and that's what we've created. We've created people who are very good at doing what they are told to do. So here we are in a time where really the world has changed and what we need from people has changed, but we haven't done anything to change how we're preparing people for the challenges. So people are doing what they've always done, but we've got these new needs to get people to do different things. We need them to think in a vacuum, which is very difficult for any people to do. We need them to think more sort of entrepreneurially. And when I say altruistic entrepreneurship, I'm not talking about being a doormat. I'm talking about balancing a healthy sense of self-respect with and ambition with the needs of other people. Because I think if you talk about service, it can be easy to think, you know, Mother Teresa, walk around barefoot. That's not what I'm suggesting. It's just as easy to make a living genuinely helping people as it is to make a living doing pointless crap that doesn't better the world in any way.
I love the fact that you're so passionate about it. I love the fact that you want to make the changes and are making the changes in your local community about the things that you do and how you work and how you connect with, engage with, collaborate and work with others. But I wonder where we're going to take this next, how we're going to make the change.
I was listening to another really interesting talk that was talking about, and I think I mentioned in that article, that the biggest epidemic facing people today in the Western world isn't obesity.
No.
It's loneliness.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
This study said that loneliness was a greater predictor of early death than obesity, smoking, alcohol.
Mm.
Because we're not designed to live that way. It comes back to the same
question. We're social beings.
We are. You know, like, it's like expecting your vacuum cleaner to make a cup of coffee. That's not what it was made for. That's not how it was made to work. No wonder that we're all falling apart and going, oh, my God, the world's going to hell in a handcart. We were not designed to live as we're living. So
I want to come back to a couple of your points.
Vacuum
then.
Cleaner.
You talk about the balance between those masculine traits and the feminine traits. And you talk about the balance between self-respect and achievement, working for others and growing and developing and getting on in the world. On a personal level, I feel my life has been driven by those masculine aspects. And only in the latter part of my life, the last 10, 15 years, have I focused a little bit more on things like that, those self-awareness and the impact that my decisions are having on me, etc. And my instant thought when you mentioned that was, but whose scales? So who says whether the balance is right?
You know, there's a quote, and I can't remember the wording. I'll probably get it completely wrong. But it goes something along the lines of judging a society by the weakest members, something like that. As long as our society, you know, and this is probably a bigger issue than anything, is having that massive divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Mm.
So that tells you that something is wrong, you know, where you've got this giant-sized disconnect. That's almost like a prehistoric situation rather than an enlightened and modern. And look, getting that balance right is not something that's going to
happen overnight or happen at a flick of a switch. It's going to take forever, won't it?
This is part of the problem that, you know, if you could bash it all down and say, right, we're going to start from scratch today. Oh, that's easy. Anyone can do that. It's a bit like renovating. You know, when you're building a new house, you can get it all right the first go. But when you are really working with what you've got, it's about saying, well, what's fixed and what can we do something about? So for starters, we can't get rid of all the rich people. We can't get rid of all the politicians, as tempting as that might be. All we can do is kind of starting from now, we can say, well, everybody who we elect or everybody who does get put into a position of power, that person, wouldn't it be good if that person was more compassionate? And I'm not talking, when I say compassion, I don't mean weakness. I mean somebody who is a better leader. And in my opinion, the first place to start with all of this, because I reckon that one of the biggest issues that we have that bloody throws a spanner in the works every step of the way, the media. The media has something, and that is something that could be sorted out freaking chop chop, because what comes out in the media is one person's account, and it's not helpful.
What is it? It's fear. Fear sells. It makes... Yeah. And in this bigger context of this cultural change that you're talking about, or the societal change, the key there for me is around the fear of control or the lack of control. Because when you have control, i.e., and there are some people who are at the top of said pyramid who have, and there are only a few of them, who have the control, what do they need to do to bring about the control of the masses? Is create fear in people's minds, or facilitate that through various processes, procedures. Think about the pandemic. I'm not suggesting that we can't and shouldn't have had lockdown. I'm just saying that a certain group of people control the masses through fear and the influence their fear and control has over us.
It's a bit like sticking a plant in a garden bed and when it gets overrun with weeds, being surprised that it's not thriving. Any person, any society is only going to go as well as the environment that it's in. And I think the media has a lot to answer for. There is so much amazing stuff going on in the world, so much amazing stuff.
And we never hear about it.
Never, never. There are clever people who are doing amazing research with ideas that if they had to even have half a go at getting them going, honestly, we would be set. But the media is something we can do something about. But I think because it's hard doesn't mean we should just all go, oh, well, you know, that's that. Barack Obama had a fabulous expression, better is good. If we all make better choices with everything that we do, if we elect better people, if we get the media to be better than what they are now, even if it's only a small margin of people who are reporting good stuff, all of this stuff will happen slowly. And when people see what's possible, they will support that and go, well, if you publish that kind of stuff, we will buy that.
So then it comes down to us, really.
Then it becomes a commercial decision. And then we can go, once there is an option, then we can go, well, I'm not going to buy your rubbish newspaper that just keeps making stuff up. People need to see what's possible. They need to see what's out there, because unless they are aware of the options.
Yeah, they're just going to go back to being factory worker.
Yeah.
Doing what I'm told.
Exactly.
I'm quite taken by the choices point that you talk about too. I do agree with you, it is about choice. Choice becomes obvious when we slightly higher up the Maslow scale. When we're focused on making ends meet, having to buy food that's canned food, we don't have the luxury of shopping at Waitrose. When those things aren't there, I think our choices can be quite limited, even as much as when it comes to changing how we do things or changing my world. Because what I see, if I'm in that group of people, is I see these people who are on the television and are making a success of themselves, talking about how to do that. And the way to do that are through those masculine qualities. So all I see is that. And therefore, that's the only thing that I want, because I want to be, I want to emulate that. I want to get out of the situation that I'm in. I can't afford to buy fresh fruit and vegetables, for example. My point simply is, I think sometimes we who have that freedom of choice place a degree of expectation on those who perhaps have less freedom of choice and don't necessarily have the right solution for those who have less freedom of choice.
There is a lot of very clear research that suggests you've got two ends of the scale. Suffering on any level, physical, emotional, suffering is always so much worse when the person doing the suffering has no choice in the matter.
There you go. Yeah.
On the other end of the scale, you've got a time where most people in the sort of Western world, people who do have choices, have way too many choices. So they become completely overwhelmed by all the choices and do nothing. What I'm suggesting is that if we could give them, the people with too many choices, help them narrow down the choices to choices that are going to be in the greater good. And particularly for the people who have limited choices, I honestly believe that the way out of the hole that a lot of those people are in is learning entrepreneurial skills, learning how to see the value of what they already have, the environment that they are already in, the people they already know, and how they can use that to serve other people, not exploit, serve other people and improve their lot in life.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. The question is, how do we find the people? How do we find the people who want to learn those skills, those entrepreneurial skills?
I came across a guy in South Africa, actually, who's doing some amazing work teaching entrepreneurial skills to people in townships. So this is not the kind of business thinking where, you know, starting an organization and having a CEO, and it's the basic buy and sell? What have I got to work with? What are the, like market research, what do the people around me need? How can I fill that need? What do I already know? The same principles that we apply to one person businesses in exactly that same format, giving that to people who are in the position where they have no choice. And this is where, for me, the altruistic entrepreneurship has probably more value for those people than it does for people at the opposite end.
We've got to do our bit in our world, in our circle of influence, to bring about that drip, drip, eventual sea change.
There's another dimension to all of this, and that is around something that's huge nowadays in the last 2 years, loneliness. There's a lot of people out there that are isolated, that feel alone, that aren't connected, that aren't able to or haven't been able to connect and grow something or develop themselves or build a business or build a community or be part of something. I wonder how what you're talking about might go some way to mitigating that loneliness for people generally.
Well, I think in my view, it's about people knowing that there is another way and not necessarily having all the answers. No one's got all the answers, but knowing that the problems we face now, all of the problems, just because they are big, doesn't mean to say we've got to come up with a solution that solves every part of it. I think chipping away at the base of the problem and knowing that lots of people doing lots of little things can make a difference.
And in service of others.
In service of others. And we're not trying, we need to change a culture. We need to change our culture. And that doesn't happen overnight. That takes a long time to happen. And just because we don't see instant change doesn't mean to say that nothing's going on.
But perhaps we have that conversation in another episode next time, perhaps.
It's good talking to you, girl.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank
and
you.
Your company. Thanks. Take care.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.
So that's it. The name's Neubronner, Dion Neubronner. You're listening to my podcast, Life, Purpose, Leadership.